For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, as you can see, Tygon is not here today. And I'm Nancy Easton. I know I have met almost all of you, and those I have not met personally I at least recognize. So I know we don't have any complete newcomers here today, but I will be speaking today a little bit about silence and the practice, how ways in which we can practice with silence. And part of how I arrived at this topic was in thinking about how on Sundays we get a lot of newcomers, because that's the day that we hold the meditation class and encourage people to come for the first time. And so I thought I would try to find a way to talk about some of the, just sort of the things that we do here and why we do them in a way that maybe will demystify some of what we do here. I know that many of us, you know, maybe grew up in, you know, some sort of variation on Judeo-Christian religion and grew up going to church or synagogue or maybe even mosque or other different practices. And for me, I grew up going to church, and I think especially Sunday morning always sort of pulls that sort of like church kind of feeling. And so maybe that's true for some of you as well. I'm going to use the word church just because that's what I'm a little more familiar with. But, you know, when you go to church, it's pretty straightforward, and it's really easy to know what you should be doing practically all the time. I mean, you know, you go and people are like, hey, hello, welcome, greetings. You know, maybe they'll show you to your seat, or maybe you just sort of figure it out. But, you know, they give you a bulletin, and they give you a, you know, there was a program. And even in the printed program in my church, there were little asterisks which would tell you, like, when you're supposed to stand up and, you know, what hymn. You know, and maybe people would pass the peace, or there would be, you know, announcements about bake sales and, you know, coffee hour afterwards and kids running around and all kinds of committees and stuff like that. And it was pretty easy to figure out, you know, going to a church for the first time, you know, kind of what you do, where you go. If you had been to some other church, it wasn't maybe so different. And I think that, you know, people come to Zen practice with all kinds of different backgrounds. Maybe going to church, maybe not going to church, maybe hating church, maybe want nothing to do with church ever again. And I think that there is a place for all of those experiences. But what I think is hard about coming to maybe a new sangha for the first time, or maybe this sangha for the first time, is in trying to understand, you know, sort of what's going on, you know? And why is everybody so quiet, and what's supposed to happen next? And so I'm hoping that we can have a little bit of a discussion at some point, but wanted to give you a little bit of background. Ancient Dragon is a part of the Soto Zen tradition of Buddhism. And, you know, I think there's a lot of debate about what Buddha said about personal enlightenment or enlightenment at all, but in Soto Zen in particular, I think there is less of a focus on personal enlightenment. That is not completely true for all forms of Zen, but I think that's more true in Soto Zen. And there is more a focus on all beings enlightening together. You know, and Buddha talked specifically about how his teaching was about, you know, suffering and the causes of suffering and the cessation for suffering. And we can think about that as personal suffering, but I think the Zen focus is more on all beings, you know, the ending of suffering for all beings, which includes you, and I think actually probably has to start with you, but it is certainly not limited to you. And so I wanted to read you something, which we are part of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, and I was I guess that's, yeah, that's what it is, SCBA. I was actually looking around on their website, and they have a statement on the beginning of their website that I think says what I want to say better than the whole rest of my talk. So I'm actually just going to read it to you right here off my iPhone. And this is their, this is just part of what they say on their front page, but I really liked it so much. It says, "The heart of Zen is selfless meditation. Its goal is to be awake to one's universal condition beyond the transiency and concerns of everyday affairs. Soto Zen offers a quiet, disciplined practice that enables us to express our inherent wisdom and composure by expanding awareness and setting aside distractions. As the mind increases its capacity to respond creatively to difficulties that arise amid the tensions of a pressure-filled life, stress is replaced by confidence and buoyancy. By seeing into the truth of one's own nature, the anxiety of self-orientation is transformed into an attitude of equanimity and caring. Soto Zen practice encourages paying attention to the workings of one's own mind and to the discovery of each person's potential for compassion and universal connection with all life. It places particular importance on living mindfully in all dimensions of daily life, including family, work, and community. Through the unfolding of selflessness, Zen practitioners expand their inherent qualities of generosity, patience, kindness, humor, and wisdom." I just love that. I read that from time to time when I'm feeling a little, you know, stressed out. It's like, oh, okay. A little refreshing reminder. So, you know, I kind of just want to talk about what are we doing here? You know, I'm hoping that we will be able to have a discussion of ways that maybe people encounter silence in their life or practice with silence in their life, or and particularly, you know, questions that people might have. And I really hope that it will be a group discussion, but I want to start by sharing my thoughts on silence and in particular touching on, I think are maybe the three really important aspects of working with silence for me, which would be deep listening, working with ambiguity, and getting in touch with what's called the one who is not busy. And so I'm going to start by reading a koan. This is a koan is a teaching story, and this particular one is Case 6 from the Gateless Gate, which is also called the Mumonkan, which originated in China. It was a series of koans that were compiled during the Song Dynasty, probably about 800 to 1,000 years ago. And you know, with koans, they always present you with a little bit of ambiguity, you know, and the object is not to understand them intellectually, but, you know, your understanding can be deep or shallow or change over time as your experience, you know, changes. And I certainly am not going to, you know, have the definitive answer for this koan for anybody else, or certainly even for myself for the rest of my life, but I wanted to talk about this as it relates to one particular aspect of silence. And so this is called Case 6, The Buddha Holds Out a Flower. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gurdrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashyapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, "I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashyapa." So, what do I want to say about this? There are actually a number of translations of this koan, and I liked this one for this particular purpose. And I'll read it again just because this is actually my favorite koan. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gurdrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashyapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, "I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashyapa." So, this is a koan that is one of a number of koans that I thought of and that Taigen helped me think of, in which the master is silent. And in fact, in this koan, up until the end, everyone is silent. And what I like about this is that silence, you know, it really presents an ambiguous situation. And it can really throw us back on ourselves. You know, you're confronted with no, you know, instructions about what's happening. And we're really kind of thrown back on our own devices. In ambiguous situations, you can make a lot of different things out of them. But we all have a tendency to bring up things that we've learned, you know, from our past. You see a situation and this is, you know, how we've learned to take care of ourselves and get ourselves into adulthood is you see a situation and you match it up with, you know, okay, I've learned this in the past, here's what's going on. And that's what we've learned is there in all kinds of situations. And we tend to, especially in anxiety, in ambiguous situations, they stir up a little bit of anxiety, you know, maybe sort of the anxiety of self-concern that they talk about in the little paragraph from SCBA. And at times, you know, we can really encounter our worst fears or our stumbling blocks or things that we particularly need to work on in ourselves. And I actually want to share with you a little bit of a story of how I discovered this one time in myself and learned a little bit about how things are not always as they appear. You know, in an ambiguous situation, we think it's X, but actually all situations are ambiguous, but in silence, it's a little bit even more ambiguous. So it's easier to see the ambiguity. But I want to talk about, I used to be afraid of dogs, and I still am a little bit afraid of dogs, but I used to be really afraid of dogs. And the way that came about is I got bitten by dogs, like a lot. Like I got bitten by my dog and my piano teacher's dog and the dogs that were running around in our sort of semi-rural neighborhood in the 70s before. I don't know if they have leash laws there now, but they, you know, I mean, it was a semi-rural neighborhood. And I got to where my own history led me to be very suspicious of dogs. And over time I started encountering dogs on the street, and they would just be like at the, you know, in Chicago, they're at the end of the leash, like, you know, yapping at me and growling and snarling and, you know, like uncanny number of dogs who are just like charging me. And I was like, I don't understand this, you know. And I remember one time there were these two girls who were walking their dog down the street, and the dog's a little bit too big for them, and he's like coming at me snarling, and they're like, we don't understand, he's really very friendly. And I was like, I started to feel like, you know, where are all these vicious dogs coming from, and where are they getting all these deluded people who think that they're actually really friendly? And, you know, I think I finally figured this out, and I have to say that I figured it out kind of by accident, and I'm not even sure when I did, and perhaps you already know what was going on in this situation, but what I didn't realize was I would walk down the street, I would see a dog, I would feel like, uh-oh, you know, I can't cross the street, whatever. I would feel even more trapped because people had told me, you know, they can sense your fear. And it's like, well, I can't get rid of my fear. What am I going to do here? And so what I would do is I would look at each and every dog straight in the eye to try to determine whether they were going to bite me, whether they were vicious, you know, and what I finally figured out, or somebody pointed out to me, or something amazing happened, which was, don't look a dog straight in the eye, because they take it as a challenge. And so it finally like dawned on me that I was in fact challenging every single dog that I saw. And, you know, I'm not sure if I was inviting them to get, sort of vicious. I think actually what I was doing was unintentionally projecting my own belief in the possibility of viciousness onto the dog. And possibly my own fear. You know, I think I maybe, you know, in my own fear, I'm stirring up fear in the dog, who then feels like he has to defend himself. He's going to do a better job of it than I am. But that all comes from, you know, my own belief in viciousness, which actually comes from, you know, maybe some level of my own fear and viciousness and defense. And you know, because you don't look for those things if you aren't familiar with them in the world, in yourself. And so what I learned from this was, don't look at the dog. And I still hold on to this sort of saying for myself as like my mantra for approaching all kinds of situations where I'm afraid. It's like, you know, okay, I'm afraid of, you know, going into this, and it's like, don't look at the dog. And so what I wanna sort of bring this back to in terms of the koan, which is, you know, by no means the definitive statement about this koan, is, you know, so we're in a situation, it's an ambiguous situation where, you know, Buddha, he comes up to the Dharma seat and he, you know, arranges himself and sits down, and everyone has come to hear a Dharma talk, and they're there and they're waiting. And Buddha sits in silence and he holds up a flower. And everyone is silent, including Buddha. And Kashyapa smiles. And so, you know, what I would say to this is, don't look at the dog. We maybe are especially inclined to, you know, and boy, I would certainly do this. You know, if I were at a lecture that Buddha was giving, I would be looking to Buddha for like, okay, what is this? You know, what does this flower represent, or what are you doing here, or what's going on here? And possibly many people in the audience were feeling that way. And what I think, you know, what I think was maybe different about Kashyapa was, Kashyapa just, you know, he had a response. That's kind of how I'm seeing this now. It's like, you know, don't look at the dog. Don't look to the teacher for the answer. You know, look into your own heart. You know, what do you see? Someone holds up a flower. You know, how lovely. Someone is, you know, honking at us in traffic. You know, grr. You know, some dog is barking at us. You know, uh-oh. There's, I think that, you know, by looking at our own reaction, this is actually a part of how we can bring compassion to the world. You know, by studying yourself and by deeply listening to a situation, you know, it's, you might find, you know, like, okay, so, you know, I smile. But I'm glad that that happened that way in this particular story, but I don't think that that's the only answer. Because in fact, you know, I think what we sometimes encounter in situations like this is, you know, you look into your heart and what you see is, you know, doubt and fear and anger. And I think that's actually okay. You know, I think I feel that way sometimes, you know, sometimes a lot. And I think that actually it's because we have those things that we can then, you know, maybe respond a little bit more compassionately or kindly to someone else. You know, I think it's in learning how to relate to our own, you know, fear and anger and viciousness that we are able to maybe respond to that a little bit more kindly in other people. And so, you know, in addition, I think, you know, my experience with the dog reminds me that things are not always how they appear to be on the surface. You know, sometimes you have to, I mean, I thought I was encountering a vicious dog, you know, again and again and again and again. And sometimes, you know, you just have to look a little bit more deeply and see the ways in which things are, you know, kind of dependently co-arising, as we call them in Zen. What that means is that things are happening, and everything is constantly, you know, sort of influencing each other while it's happening. So I'm influencing the dog is influencing me. It just, you know, it kind of goes on endlessly, where you can't exactly separate out any one cause. Everything is causing itself and causing everything around it. And so it's important to, you know, listen deeply, listen below the surface, and which is really hard to do when there's a lot going on, you know, when there's hymns and talks and, you know, whatever. I think silence, you know, whether formal or informal, really promotes that kind of deep listening apart from distraction, you know, and awkward moments of kind of not knowing can really teach us, you know, hopefully in a kind fashion, you know, who's awkward, what's awkward, what's happening here, what's not happening here. And in ways that would be very hard to do without the silence. So, you know, we sit and we face a wall, but we also, we do lots of other things here in silence, whether it's, you know, walking and encountering, you know, what it feels like to move through the room. Listening to, you know, each other and how we interact with each other. So, very, very briefly, I'm going to actually talk for a moment about another important quality that silence can help us develop, which is encountering the one who is not busy. And this comes from another koan, case 21 from the Book of Serenity. I'm just going to read it really briefly and focus really just on the concept. The koan is Yunyan sweeps the ground, and the case says, as Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dao Wu said, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know there's one who isn't busy. Dao Wu said, if so, then there's a second moon. Yunyan held up the broom and said, which moon is this? So I actually really just want to focus on the first part where Yunyan is sweeping the ground, you know, presumably outside the temple, and his Dharma brother Dao Wu said, too busy. And Yunyan says, you should know there's one who isn't busy. And what I like about that is, you know, somebody is watching you do something and says, oh, you're too busy. You know, you should be, I'm not sure what he thought he should be doing, but, you know, too busy. And Yunyan is saying, there's one who's not busy. You know, and what goes into the difference of those two things? You could be sweeping the ground and be too busy. You could be sweeping the ground and be not busy. You know, whether you're sweeping the ground or driving through rush hour traffic or walking across the room or cleaning the bathroom, there are ways in which, you know, you can sort of regard things as just another chore to get through, or, you know, let's just check that off on our list. I am, you know, sort of the biggest offender with that sort of thing. But what the one who is not busy is about is encountering in the space around the things that you're doing, just being fully present with what you're doing. I think, you know, I think we've heard this before where, you know, you can just sort of attend to each thing in the moment. And if what's happening is an interruption of the thing that you thought you were doing, well, then that's what's happening. So it's a way of, you know, trying to encounter each thing as it's happening. And I think, you know, if you're just there and you're fully present for each activity, then, you know, there's no real hassle. You're not too busy. You're just doing what you're doing. You know, and I think that really is another way of working with silence to help bring, you know, a calm and compassionate presence to your life. Even in the midst of activity, you know, I think sometimes you can get kind of overwhelmed by having an agenda, but silence around things can help us to, you know, re-encounter ourselves and, you know, restore sanity without a rally. Apparently we can do this just, you know, being here, coming back to the here and now, and being apart from distraction. And that's where, you know, we're here and we're silent, and sometimes it can feel hard to follow along, or, you know, even just before, you know, getting up and doing a talk, I consulted with Hogetsu about, like, okay, I can't remember what the things are that I'm supposed to do in what order, and you know, there's ways in which it's, you get confused and you know need to ask some questions, but then there is the silence of just being there and being with whatever it is that's happening. So I forgot to mention that the title for my talk actually was going to be, you know, is silence actually golden? And because I think I thought about, you know, silence and what would I say, and I was thinking about that old saying, you know, silence is golden. And one of the great things about giving a talk is that you have to look up all those things that you would just say because without thinking, because when you're going to talk about it, it's like, oh, I have no idea what I'm saying. So I looked up silence is golden because I wasn't really sure what it meant. And what it actually refers to is, you know, kind of an old adage about holding your tongue, the wisdom of holding your tongue. And I thought about that and how that relates to what we're doing here. And I think that actually I didn't like it very much. I thought, you know, if we're just sitting here holding our tongue, I think that is actually really missing the point, you know. And, you know, because I would really want our Sangha to be a place where anyone can ask, you know, all kinds of questions on all kinds of levels about, you know, what's really going on here. And not have to just, you know, hold your tongue or try to look like, you know, try to look like you have no thoughts or no feelings or anything like that. It's hopefully, you know, not about that. And that's not even going to help because the ways in which we can be most helpful are in, you know, the ways in which we maybe identify with somebody who's in pain or someone who is, you know, afraid and the ways that we've encountered that in ourselves. So silence, you know, I don't know if it's golden or not. I think it's silence, you know, and we make a lot of different things out of it. But I think it can, you know, really offer us kind of a golden opportunity to, you know, deeply look at and listen to our lives and, you know, and to wake up to our life. You know, while we're here and when then, you know, when we take that out into the rest of the world, there's all kinds of ways of building silence into activities that you're in, you know, whether it's just paying attention to the activity or, you know, building a little bit of space around each thing so that you can, you know, reflect. And that is hopefully, that's what practice helps me with. I guess I don't want to put my agenda for what I hope practice does for anybody else. That would maybe not be so fair. But what I'm hoping is that we can, you know, have a little bit more of a discussion now about other people's thoughts about this and you know, or questions that people have. And so let me just sort of stop there with my thoughts. And anybody who wants to start, you know, any brave soul, just please sort of say whatever you're thinking about with respect to silence.
Thank you.
Dansan.
I really liked it. Everybody has been really good. You know, when you come in, I came in to Ancient Dragon when Ancient Dragon was at the Central. But everybody's been really good at answering questions when I've had questions, which have been a lot of questions. But I think that there is a point for me that it is good to have silent, like all day sittings where it's supposed to be silent. Sometimes even then I forget that I'm supposed to be silent, but to just kind of zip it. And so instead of always asking somebody else for the answer, kind of figuring it out on my own and kind of watching and sitting and listening to the teacher or the Tenzo and kind of figuring it out on my own, I think that's really helpful for me to kind of figure things out. And so not always to get that opportunity to ask those questions and to be talking. And because sometimes that can get in the way, or I tend to always have my foot in my mouth. And so it's nice to kind of stop that and kind of have that time to learn to stop it. And so to practice here, you know, with stopping it and that has helped quite a bit in my home life with my partner and my daughter, so, and my cat.
So would you say it's having to have some time before you can ask the question? Just, you know, you have the question, you sit with it for a little while.
I usually end up figuring it out if I sit and watch. You know, it's usually something, you know, about practice. And if I sit and watch, then I usually figure it out throughout the day. If I don't, then I will ask because that's what I do. And because I'm curious and I want to know. And so, or I'll ask, you know, Douglas or, you know, but mentality too, to kind of, I'll be like, oh no, what do I do? I don't know the answer. But it's kind of nice to be able to be like, okay, just sit with it. You know, because that gives it, that's that practice of working through that anxiety and like, oh no, what do I do? You know? So I kind of feel like that sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. But thank you.
Thanks.
Silence topic very interesting. This year I went to a retreat where it's all called silent meditation. So the moment we get off the van and went to our room, we're wearing a tag, I'm observing silence, and it's for 5 days.
Oh wow.
My whole being was in rebellion. And I've never been silent for 5 days, and that idea alone scared me a lot. The first hours were, I find it boring. I just had some anger going on inside me.
Mm-hmm.
But then as time goes on, I can't believe it. This is wonderful. I was able to tap into that part of me that I never discovered before. And I noticed a lot of transformation in my life after that. But 5 days is, the first few hours was hell, but after that I found something profoundly enriching, spiritually and at a deeper level. And it's actually a good time for me to ask a lot of questions. And funny, it was amazing, answers coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Questions about life, about what path to take. And the universe is very compassionate. I mean, mm-hmm. The answers were given, not right there and then, but it's just like you have a colon, you know, to download. Yeah. Which ones are my attachments, which ones are my true happiness? And the universe just made the answers for me. I'm not going to go into details because there's a lot. I've been through a lot in my life, and I was so thankful. There's someone or something that's very compassionate out there that I was able to tap into, and I was so thankful because of that silence.
Mm-hmm.
And now I go to bars and I kind of... Like, or when I play the radio in the car, it's not the same anymore. Once you tap into that silence, it's not the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cannot describe it in words. It's just that calm, peaceful part of you that wherever you are, watching TV, or it's just some part of you is craving for it. Something behind, like not this body, but something behind this, something bigger, something enormous is actually observing and just enjoying that silence, enjoying that peace and bliss.
Yeah.
So
it seems like you're kind of talking about how when in, you know, ordinary sort of mode that we're all in, you know, we're kind of always looking outside of ourselves, and silence feels like a, you know, an absence. It's like, you know, there's nothing there. It sounds like you found so much more.
It's full of everything.
Yeah.
that silence, it's the source of everything, actually.
Yeah.
I experienced that. It comes and goes, and sitting with yourself, I find it boring at first. I can't sit for even 10 minutes. I have to do something. There's something in me that I have to do something. I have to keep busy. I have to go with what others are doing. And then there's part of me that pulls me back, like, hey, you know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's very compassionate, very loving, reassuring that it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do it, but you know, you can be still and be full of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
That was fine.
So hard to get ourselves to do that sometimes.
But it just happened. I think it's some form of grace that I was able to get into that. So
thank you for
thank you.
That's it.
I forget your name.
Beth.
Beth. No, thank you. Beth, I'm dancing song. This gratitude for silence. And I was thinking about how early in Zen practice, and still to this day, when I'm with some of my teachers, that we go for long periods without ever saying a word to each other. It could be sharing a cup of tea, taking a walk, moving in a meditation hall. I remember early mornings during silent retreats, you know, when somebody comes for you for Dokusan, walking in silence, just following the person, because you might have to walk through pathways in the dark, and not knowing what to do when I entered the room to talk to a teacher, and really having this all communicated with very few words, if any at all, and the kind of intimacy that is possible with spaciousness. So there's something that feels so warm and tender to me when you talk about this topic, Nancy, the spaciousness, that maybe it's not just a silence of voice or sound, but a bodily felt experience, whether one is talking or not, of having this envelope of openness and acceptance and communication and intimacy. So I'm grateful for being able to share that with everyone in here and be bringing it up.
Thank you. Thanks for talking about your experience. I saw. Laura.
I'll just build on what Hogetsu just said. I live alone, and so I can have a lot of silence at home if I choose it, but it's very different to be silent in community. And I think that when we talk to each other, we don't look for all the other ways we're communicating with each other. We just rely on language. But if we eliminate language, then we push ourselves to, or we explore ourselves and look at other ways that we're communicating with each other. And I think we find many things that we would not find if we just stayed with language, which in some ways is easy. Or at least in our culture, it's what we do almost all of the time. So I come here for the silence, for the opportunity to have the bell ring now, be silent together until the bell ring.
Yeah.
I think of it as a gift from the Sangha. Not too many of the places that you can go for that in 2010 in Chicago.
I actually can echo of what all three of you were saying. I know the first time I did a 5-day sesshin, it was in a remote location. Our sesshins are a little different because we're here and we have to commute, and this was in a remote location. And I remember sitting, during a break out in the parking lot with, everyone else, and we all sort of, I felt a little dispirited, and everybody looked a little dispirited, and, and it's just a break. And suddenly I felt this feeling of such gratitude that other people were willing to hang out here and do this too. And I didn't have to say anything to entertain or explain. And just so wonderful to have that feeling of presence that others will support for me. But, well, you were going to...
Oh, yes. Thank you very much for your talk. I really... really love what you said about the ambiguity of silence, and hearing what some of the people have just said now. Maybe you want to share an experience that maybe you had as well. When I first came to Zen practice, the silence threw me for a loop, I would say. And the ambiguity of it, culturally, there was nothing similar, and I couldn't help but feel a little coldness, sternness, severity, that sort of thing. And I don't really know what caused that to shift, if it was just experience, getting comfortable, things like that. But if anyone here is feeling or has felt similar things, don't worry about it. That's what I have to say. Thank you.
What's your mantra? Don't worry about it. Mine is don't look at the dog.
Yeah, I
wanted
to comment on that. You know, from my experience, I always feel that ambiguity around silence in lots of places, because I know that it sometimes makes people uncomfortable. And it's certainly made me uncomfortable. I feel like, am I doing this right? I need more feedback, you know? And it's, there's something about, like, that I've been working with, is just developing when, that the silence is also a bodily attitude, and that there's something, there's that communication, like if somebody needs a conversation, it's like, okay, I could do that. You know, like, not to freeze people out, but then also, like, how to allow the space to be. But there's something about the silence that I agree, especially at Zen centers, they can feel very cold and unwelcoming and weird, and, you know, and that's all my own projection, and some of that is, you know, some people are, like, you know, kind of isolated and don't want to talk to anybody. Even that's what they have at Zen centers, so there's probably that piece of things. But there, you know, there's also the sense of it's a gift to receive the opportunity to have space, you know, with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, most of us are pushing our own agendas, and for me, I often feel very pained by noticing the fact that of me wanting to push my agenda on somebody else. And so I try to step back and say, okay, well, let's give some space here. So for me, it's not that I want to be unfriendly, but it's like, I'm just like, okay. Mm-hmm. I can let it go and see what happens here.
So. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your talk. I'm resonating with all of this, and it seems like a lot of my life, that my sense of self comes from that constant chatter in my mind of, you know, like you're going, I'm sweeping now, I'm working, I'm always working. And that becomes what carries on my sense of self throughout the day, is that self-chatter. And when I'm silent, and that silence starts to seep in so that I have a little bit of space between my thoughts, there's almost a fear that comes up, like, who am I? I'm going to lose myself. But then that deeper self comes in, sort of like, you know, not the two moons, the one. Mm-hmm. And I think that our language, you know, creates a false sense of self, one, because, you know, it's not real, and two, because it never quite gets all the way there. Like, we can say to somebody, you know, stay away from fire, it will burn you, but it's not the same as the sensation of burning. There's almost like a, oh, okay, I'm going to go check that out. Because you haven't actually experienced it, you've only thought it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And so, you know, when the Buddha's holding up a flower, it's not, I'm going to describe a flower to you. It's, here's the actual experience. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the two moons as relating to that, and that just sort of turned my thought. It's like, okay, right, yeah, experience. Not our description of experience. Thank you. Kathy?
I really appreciate this discussion and your talk, and people's comments are stirring up things for me. And I was thinking about the first time I really encountered this kind of silence. I could really relate to you. It was at Green Gulch, and I had gone for a week, and when people, I was walking to the ocean, and people, I would think they would smile and say hello, and people didn't look at me, and they looked down or looked away, and I was like, you know, there was this sense of feeling initially kind of iced out, or something's wrong, or it's like, what am I doing here? Or, you know, it was just all kinds of reaction. But there, over time, I began to realize, they're deep in thought. This is a retreat. There's stuff going on with them. And somehow that gave me permission to let go of this interpersonal persona that I'm so used to always having, you know, saying hi, hello, how are you, or being engaged in that, and allow, to let that fall away, and just kind of be in the moment, and it does allow you to go to a deeper level of awareness. And so here in Chicago, you know, it's in and out of that. I relate to what you're saying. I have a to-do list, and I'm going from one thing to the next. So occasionally, when I can let that drop away, and things are a little more relaxed, I'm really grateful for the silence and for other people who understand it and allow it as well.
Yeah. Is that Jeremy? I can't see your face, but it could be.
I was going to ask the question of, based on the last statement, do you, or does everyone, if anyone would like to answer this question, really think that that kind of like a learning period, I guess, as to how Zen practitioners kind of relate to each other in the Zendo, where you have to go through that kind of icy phase to figure out, well, it's not that, you know, it's smell bad, it's because people are not do you think that that's necessary? Or is, you know, would it be better maybe if people were given heads up, like, hey, this is kind of how it is, so I don't know if anyone wants to.
Well, in that situation, I knew how it was. I mean, I knew going in it was a sound retreat, but I personally had not experienced it before, so I think you can know something intellectually, but when you haven't experienced it yet, you don't know how it's going to feel.
Mm-hmm. What about here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate with like a first-time newcomer? I guess that's maybe specifically what I was referring to. And is there value to going through that, or is it better just to skip it and be like, this is the convention?
To me, it's about our responses to it. And so I think it's perfectly appropriate to tell people, you know, it's not because you smell bad, but that iciness, it really is not about the person. Mm-hmm. It's about our response to it. And there's no quick way around that. There's no way, you know, other than to go into that and see, why am I responding like this? And I think for each person, it's a different answer.
Mm-hmm. I think we run the risk sometimes of, you know, there's always that risk of when you don't explain something, someone could sort of just decide, okay, you know what, I can't deal with this, I hate this. I felt that way about Zen a lot in the beginning, and, you know, it took a long time for me to be willing to come back consistently for all kinds of reasons, but it's sort of an imperfect science, you know. It's like you can never really totally know what someone else's experience is and whether they're finding silence friendly or unfriendly, or, you know, whether they've got something else going on. I'm happy that we can, you know, open up a discussion about it so that people can get what they themselves are hoping to get from a discussion like this. We're getting so close to the end, but I do want to leave time for questions.
I'll try to make it quick.
Thoughts.
So I wanted to say something about dogs. I was really touched by your story of fear of dogs, because I've kind of had a similar experience, which is not fear of dogs, but kind of a little bit of a dislike of dogs. So what I've... and that was more kind of in the past, because over the years I've been working on really expressing kindness and friendliness towards dogs and really loving dogs. So kind of like an example of that I've thought of recently is I was biking around the neighborhood here, and I came up to an intersection and stopped, and there was a car next to me with a dog hanging out the window, and I said, "Hey, bud, hey," and kind of stuck out my hand and kind of petted him, and the owner kind of looked over and was like, "What's going on back there?" You know, I was kind of having this intimate moment with this dog. And so for me, I feel like what's to connect with that, silence, as everyone's been saying, silence gives us this opportunity to check our assumptions and really see our assumptions and, you know, see what's going through our head, because, you know, there's really no such thing as silence. There's really sounds happening all the time. And the composer John Cage said that what silence is allowing sounds to be themselves, allowing sounds to be there without kind of arranging them into the storyline, or to actually see how we arrange sounds into a storyline, how that's continually happening. And like you, like your solution to the fear of dogs problem was it don't look at the dogs? Is that what it was? And it's kind of interesting to me how that kind of still kind of shows a certain assumption, like it's the assumption that, you know, if I look at a dog, it's gonna go into attack mode. You know, so there's, you know, there's still an assumption there that's kind of, but you can see how that assumption arose out of your past karma of having this fear of dogs. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, it's just kind of interesting to see how that happens.
Yeah, my mantra isn't, I have learned over time that that's not the greatest, because you can't just sort of not look at a situation. You're kind of saying you have to actually really look at a situation. And I think you're more, that's more true than just don't look at the dog. But, you know, maybe don't look at the dog the way that I was looking at the dog. Don't project onto the dog.
Douglas. Can I?
Yeah.
I really appreciated some of the comments, and I think that I think it would be worthwhile to help people understand that there won't be talking in the center of that sort of thing. And I think that I think to Roy's point, I think people will still have the same reaction, because we're taught to speak in order mm-hmm. to interact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can explain that it's quiet, it's not speaking in order to allow people to retain their mindfulness, appreciate this moment, not get distracted. You know, and there are clear points, even the story of Shakyamuni Buddha and the flower in Mahakashapa. You know, the Buddha shows the flower not to talk about this is what Buddha is, or give some present explanation of the Dharma. It's an actual direct presentation in this moment of what is here in this moment. But there's still an interaction there, right? I mean, he's presenting it to the Sangha, and Mahakashapa responds. There is interaction there. Even in the silence of the Zendo, we are responding to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we acknowledge people are there. We bow. We do things together, even though we aren't speaking. And that is, you know, the experience of Buddha right there. The world isn't—it's not some static, abstract thing. It's we are here mm-hmm. together, and we do interact. But I like the and. You know, first-time visitor might not know that sort of explanation, but needs to. I think it would be a good idea to help build the expectation. I like that idea.
Mm-hmm.